Every Monday morning, we hear the reports of weekend violence. Does that coverage really inform us about what's happening? And how much does it reinforce stereotypes about parts of Chicago, especially on its south side? Overcoming those stereotypes is part of the point behind Chicago journalist Natalie Moore's new book.
Our world brimmed with similar middle-class Black families rooted in Black identity. We were neither special nor an anomaly in Chicago, but the Cosby label stuck.
We'll talk about the South Side, a portrait of Chicago and American segregation coming up this hour on the 21st. Later, NPR science correspondent Shankar Vedantam on the new second season of his podcast, Hidden Brain.
How the mind works, how the brain produces thoughts, how this produces, you know, feelings and opinions and attitudes, these are really big and important questions that we're only beginning to get a handle on.
That's all coming up this hour on a special encore edition of the 21st. Stay tuned. You're listening to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. This is a special rebroadcast of a previous episode. Segregation is crippling because it's the common denominator to many challenges in Black communities, whether we're talking about violence, housing, jobs, education, even access to food. The unofficial separate but equal isn't working out too well for us. So writes Chicago journalist Natalie Moore in her new book, The South Side, A Portrait of Chicago and American Segregation. Her book attempts to break down the stereotypes and to get beyond the language we often use to describe the South Side of Chicago. It's a detailed portrait of a place Natalie Moore knows intimately because it's her home. This is an issue Natalie has been covering, well, since even before she was a classmate of mine back at Northwestern University, which is when I first met her. She even helped narrate a tour of her South Side where she grew up for all of us at Medill. Today, we're going to talk about the nuances of life on Chicago's South Side and how much it reflects modern segregation in America. Natalie, welcome to the 21st.
Thanks for having me, Nyla.
So if we think about this, Natalie, it's Monday morning, and every Monday morning in the summer, you and I know this drill well from our time at WBEZ. You see the headlines of tallies of violence. And I think it tends to reinforce this notion that Chicago is the so-called murder capital of America, which isn't exactly what the New York Times said yesterday. And it's a very extensive coverage of Memorial Day weekend. But I wonder what you think about particularly that piece yesterday, but also sort of if you can take a step back at the way that we're reporting violence, particularly in Chicago, and what you think that says about the problem.
I've always had an issue with the way violence is covered, and it's hard because shouldn't these type of things be covered? But if you don't have balance of coverage in those violent neighborhoods, it gives the impression that that's the only thing that's there. And the Monday morning roundup, you know, we all just wait and brace ourselves for the numbers, and then we report them. And you don't see this happening in other cities. And Chicago does have more murders than any other city in the country, but it is not the murder capital. The equalizer, if you do per capita murders, it would be a different number. But nonetheless, we lack a lot of nuance in the collective media coverage and unpacking some of the issues about why there is violence. And as far as the New York Times piece goes, before I had even seen it, people were emailing me like, hey, what are your thoughts on this? It was very well written, and it did put a human face to violence. But it didn't tell you anything about the neighborhoods. It didn't tell you anything about how guns get there. It didn't tell you about any of the challenges in the neighborhoods. To me, it felt like reporting in a vacuum, and I don't know if people learned anything new besides what they already know, that there are some violent places in Chicago where Black people live, and those can turn into stereotypes because people, if that is their only interaction or intersection with those neighborhoods because they don't visit or don't know anyone, they're going to think that it's just a Wild Wild West shootout in those neighborhoods all the time when there are people who are trying to better their neighborhood, there are block clubs. You know, these are places where people live and they're filled with humanity.
When we think about that, Natalie, I wonder, I think for people outside of Chicago, I wonder how much they see headlines about Chicago and wonder why Chicago ends up being so much of a focus. And I wonder how much of you think when we talk about, I want to talk about national media first before we get to local media, how much of that you think, and even international coverage. Natalie, I can't count how many times you've been pulled to be on the BBC or other international news outlets to talk about violence in Chicago. And how much of that do you think is simply because people see this as President Obama's hometown and therefore a national and international story?
I absolutely think that, and I'm trying to blame Obama for the city's problems, but because this is his hometown, I believe that has brought attention. One example with the BBC, there was a shooting a few years ago in a park on the city's southwest side, and no one died. And I was asleep when it happened, and I get a call in the wee hours in the morning from the BBC asking me to be on. I said, well, I wasn't there. But one, I thought it was peculiar that they were even interested in a story about a shooting at a park where there were no fatalities. And when I did go on to try to use this opportunity to contextualize the issues of violence, the first thing they said was, so, reporting from Barack Obama's hometown, here's Natalie Moore. So, you know, that lends credence to my theory that Obama is the focal point as to why there's attention. And then media sometimes acts like a pack. And if they see one media outlet covering something, others tend to follow. So there is a little bit of a herd mentality that's there.
I'm speaking with WBEZ Chicago Southside reporter Natalie Moore. She's the author of a new book. It's called The Southside, A Portrait of America, of Chicago and American Segregation. As always, if you have questions or comments, you can tweet us at 21st Show. Natalie, I think you should contextualize for us. When we look at the violence, when we look at this year in particular in Chicago, what do you think people should know about, first of all, about the numbers and its place in Chicago's history?
Well, we go back to history. Chicago has always been a violent city, and that's not an excuse, but we need to understand our history. When I was reporting my book, I have a chapter about violence, and it's called We Are Not Chirac, which is the playoff of Chicago in Iraq, which is a nickname for the city. And even back in the turn of the century, Chicago had more murders than New York or L.A., and a lot of that had to do with the mob presence, prohibition, and even back in the early 20th century, the Tribune had a clock that was counting the murders, similar to how we see murders being counted today. So that was actually pretty stunning to look at old Tribune articles and to see that.
Well, and you have in the book, there's passages you pull from Tribune stories from the 70s or even earlier, and it almost seems like the exact same story that's being written today.
Right. So one, we've been violent, and that was white violence. And Khalil Muhammad has a book called The Condemnation of Blackness, where he does talk about Chicago, but how violence became racialized. When that violence was happening in Chicago, it was among ethnic white immigrants, and it was seen as society's problems. And you had settlement workers helping, and you had this looked at as a collective city issue. When blacks were violent, it was looked at, well, black community, that is your issue. And there were fewer resources. You didn't have the same settlement house. When I say settlement house, think Jane Addams. You didn't have that type of help on the South Side. And so it was looked at as contained. And that's still sort of the mentality today. The violence that we see in black neighborhoods are ones that have high poverty, high crime, high unemployment, and you know that's not by accident that you have communities that are under-resourced and have those type of systemic problems that are going to have the kind of violence, gun violence that we've seen.
We're going to talk about all of those systemic problems, jobs, education, even access to food. But Natalie, I wanted to ask you about the term Chirac, because I think that's a very controversial term in Chicago. There are activists who have fought and said, we refuse this label. We don't want this impression. But I wonder if you could explain a little of not just that label, but also the psychological effect that may have. You write in the book a little bit about media coverage of violence and how much that even impacts even children who live in those communities.
Yeah, Chirac was is a term that popped out of a subgenre of rap culture known as drill music, and it was seen as a badge of honor, and there were some songs about it, and then it became embraced by youth, and now we even hear it in the mainstream, and the idea is that Chicago is more violent than Iraq. So it's already a complicated, not entirely accurate notion to use that term, but embracing a term like that to say, hey, we are violent and we like that, and we're going to have T-shirts around it, and then we have Spike Lee have his movie with the same name, which also, in my opinion, didn't really get behind some of the issues that we see with violence focused on the Inglewood neighborhood on the South Side. And so there has been pushback to say, you know, this is not who we are, we shouldn't be embracing this, and this does not by any means tell the story of Black Chicago.
That's Natalie Moore, who's joining us. She's the author of The South Side, A Portrait of Chicago and American Segregation. And I should say, thanks for making time to join us, because you're still on maternity leave, if people can hear.
I hope that the crying baby in the background has stopped. If anyone heard.
Not at all. I just wanted to explain the context for everybody who was listening. You know, Natalie, I think in many ways you wrote this book, not just for Chicago, but for people everywhere to understand the city's South Side. So I wanted to ask you first what you want people to know as a journalist who's covered the city. What do you think is important for people to know?
I've actually evolved since I wrote the book. My thesis, first and foremost, is that until we address segregation, we are going to continue to be a city and a region of inequities. Chicago is unique because it is a diverse city, but it is so segregated. And when I talk about the problems in some of these communities, and this goes back to hyper-segregation, it also goes back to bad housing policies in the 20th century that promoted white flight, and it promoted whites moving to the suburbs by favoring loans. The GI Bill favored whites with home ownership. The FHA favored white suburbs and created a path for white flight. And even though that happened, you know, in the last century, we're still seeing the effects of that, and we're still seeing some deleterious housing policies that are affecting our neighborhoods and have really obliterated a generation of Black wealth, because that's how we're taught to build wealth in this country, is through home ownership. So there's a little bit of history that's in the book, but there's also, you know, what do we look like now? Since the book has come out, some of the negative feedback from people who have not read the book has been, oh, well, if Black people were just better parents, Black neighborhoods are vast wastelands. And these are from white internet commenters who have never been to these neighborhoods. And so that's just another example of how segregation can allow for these stereotypes. But I also want people to think about their own housing choices, even if they live outside of the city of Chicago. If you live in Naperville, or if you live in Deerfield, or you live in the North Shore, there's a reason why you were able to move there, and it's not just, oh, well, I saved money and I bought a house. You know, there was federal policy that allowed for those type of communities to be built, and there's a reason why you decided to live there. And so one thing I would like is for people to start thinking about their own housing choices, because the root of segregation goes back to how communities are created and housing policies.
There's a really interesting statistic that you have, Robert Sampson, found that in Chicago, gentrification stopped when neighborhoods were 40% Black. Like, there's just sort of this point where, given the percentage of how many Black people there are in the neighborhood, gentrification actually slows down.
Yeah, and there's a lot of gentrification is a hot topic in the city of Chicago, and sometimes I think that it's a misused word. There certainly are areas that are experiencing gentrification, but that is not really the story of what's happening in Chicago neighborhoods. And there have been other studies out there, too, that show that Black neighborhoods on the South Side of Chicago don't gentrify. And there was one study that compared Pilsen to Bronzeville that I write about. And Pilsen is a Mexican-American area on the south side that's been going through a lot of change. And so that neighborhood was seen as, oh, well, that's ethnic fun. That's Mexican tacos and margaritas. And Bronzeville was still seen as a violent place, and those are black people. And there's another statistic that I have in one of the chapters about how about perceptions of neighborhoods. And if there's a black neighborhood that meets the criteria of whites as far as good schools, stable community, and all the things that, you know, these white families might be looking for, they still will not choose that neighborhood if it is mostly black.
Natalie, what do you want people to know? We just have about a minute left before we take a break, but what do you want them to know from the perspective of someone who was born and raised on the south side of Chicago?
To move beyond the stereotypes and to realize that these are places with real people that have real challenges that have been codified ever since really black people arrived in the city from the Great Migration. And having an equitable city means equity for everyone. You know, if you're white and you live on the north side and you think that this isn't your problem, you know, there is a burden of segregation that affects an entire city and an entire region.
That's Natalie Moore. She's taking part in Chicago's Printers Row Lit Fest, actually, this Sunday. When we come back, we're going to continue the conversation with her. She's the author of The South Side, A Portrait of Chicago and American Segregation. If you have questions or comments, you can always join us. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. You can tweet to 21st Show, and we'll pick up this conversation in just a few minutes. Stay tuned to this Encore edition of The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. This is a special rebroadcast of a previous episode. Chicago is known as one of the most segregated cities in America. How much does Chicago's segregation reflect simply 21st segregation in this country? We've been talking about that with WBEZ Chicago journalist Natalie Moore, whose new book is called The South Side, A Portrait of Chicago and American Segregation. She's taking part in Chicago's Printers Row Lit Fest and will be speaking there this Sunday, but joins us now. Let's go to Creel in Champaign. Hi, Creel. Welcome to The 21st. What's your question or comment?
Hi, Nyla. I'm glad that you're giving us such a diverse coverage for our area. It really matters. I have a question for Ms. Moore. She repeatedly says that the blacks in South Chicago have faced challenges, quote unquote, especially with accruing financial wealth and having been segregated as far as banking and being able to make progress. My question is, how does this excuse the shootings and the deaths? There really is no excuse. I'm poor and I haven't killed anybody. Could she bring that forward and maybe discuss what the cultural difference is, where this has occurred, why that has occurred in South Chicago?
Thanks for that call, Creel. Natalie?
A little trouble hearing her, but what I did hear was that she's poor and has never killed anybody.
Correct.
So that's the other thing about some of these neighborhoods on Chicago's south and west side is that they can be looked at as that this is what all people are doing or most of people are doing. The people who are committing violence, it is a very small number. And a lot of it is interpersonal violence, people who know each other. So, you know, I would never say, oh, well, because this is a poor neighborhood, that's an excuse for gun violence. It's not an excuse, but it's also part of the reason if you have neighborhoods that don't have, you know, jobs or options for people, they are going to turn to other means. But that said, it is still a very small population that is doing this. And I would never say that, you know, all poor people, or if you're poor, that means that you're going to turn to violence. So while I talked about the current policies and historic policies that have shaped these neighborhoods and have left them troubled, there's also the piece about access to guns. And yes, you know, personal responsibility is important. You know, I would never, you know, excuse anyone who is shooting someone. But I do sometimes cringe at that being the first go-to.
Natalie, what percentage?
It makes it sound like all black communities are filled with black people who don't have any morals, when we're talking about just a handful of people.
Right. I mean, when we think about what percentage of it, and actually I think the New York Times actually covered a little bit of this in their coverage this weekend, actually, there is a statistic, and I wonder if you'd help me out. I don't know if you know the exact one, but what percentage of the violence is committed in those crimes by, I guess, what percentage of the population it represents, if we're thinking about neighborhoods?
I don't have that stat offhand, but, you know, I can just say that it's small. And a lot of the violence, too, is people kill people who they know, and they kill people in proximity to them. And that's the general rule of thumb, you know, not just with Chicago. And so, you know, the relationships are intertwined. And at one point, the Chicago Police Department was even trying to predict who would be a victim or a perpetrator of gun violence based on the same kind of analytics that may be used for social media.
Mm-hmm. So let's get into some of the background of what you said about housing policies. And I think we have to start this, though, with just a migration pattern point to remind people, because so much of this book is also about your family story. And I've actually known you for a really long time, and I don't think I knew that your grandmother was born in Springfield. I wanted to ask you how much of your family story is a reflection of the Great Migration.
Well, I'm a granddaughter of the Great Migration, and I wouldn't be here if it weren't for them. I wouldn't have lived my own South Side experience. My mother's parents came from Georgia after World War II. My grandmother came here first because she had two cousins who were living in Woodlawn, and that's typically how migration happened. You had a relative who was already here, and then you follow. And then my grandfather, they were childhood sweethearts. He came after he finished his service in the war. It was between Harlem and Chicago, but my grandmother was in Chicago, so he came to the South Side. And on my father's side, we actually had some relatives here before the Great Migration, and we're not really sure why. You know, a lot of time mapping our history as Black Americans can be pretty tough. But my grandfather came from Nashville. He ran away from home because he was sick of the racism in the South, and he came to live with his grandmother and his great aunt, who had already been here. He had two brothers who had to flee Nashville because of racial violence, and my grandfather, who was younger, felt like he just didn't want to possibly suffer that himself, so he came here to Chicago. And so my grandparents all, you know, worked hard. They became homeowners. They helped build the sturdy working black middle class that we see in many, many neighborhoods here in Chicago.
Well, and I wanted to talk about that because I first wanted to ask you what you want people to know about your childhood growing up in Chatham. There's a part of the book where you start actually the book talking about the Cosby Show and the Huxtables and sort of how America was obviously clearly before what we know now about Bill Cosby, very enraptured with this notion of affluent black America.
Yeah. You know, as a child, I may not have had the words to articulate what I was seeing as far as racial disparities, but I knew that black people suffer from stereotypes and black communities did. And I grew up in a stable black middle-class neighborhood called Chatham. And, you know, my parents went to college. I had friends who went to, you know, who were smart in school. You know, there were lots of civic organizations in the neighborhood, a lot of black-owned businesses. You know, it was a great place, and I remember feeling like this isn't reflected in news coverage because, as I mentioned earlier with the violence, coverage, you know, it's amped up, but it's pretty much been the same, that a lot of these communities are only covered through that lens. And I knew that my community and many communities like that, that was not the story of Black Chicago.
One of the things I wanted to ask you about was, we talked about this just before the break about Black homeowners and Black middle-class homeowners and wealth and a comparison of wealth among Black Americans versus white Americans. And there are a lot of complex reasons for that. But I thought we should start with something. Your dad calls it the Black tax, as you write about in the book. What's that?
If you live in a Black neighborhood, your home value is going to be valued less, even if it's similar to a white home in a white neighborhood. You may have fewer goods and services in your neighborhood, such as grocery stores or retail. At some of those stores, you may be paying higher prices because of that. And one thing that I say over and over again in the book is that this is not a class issue. This is a race issue. During the housing boom of the 2000s, a neighborhood like Chatham, saw a rise in home values as other neighborhoods did. But it turns out that there were lending institutions that were purposefully giving bad loans and risky loans to Black people simply because they're Black. And then people may remember that Attorney General Lisa Madigan sued Countrywide because of their discriminatory, predatory practices in Black and Latino communities, and won a huge settlement. So even though I'm talking about the past, we still see things that are happening today. And so why am I connecting the dots on this? If you get a neighborhood that's full of foreclosures, or a neighborhood that was stable that has foreclosures and vacancies, that can attract crime, that can attract elements into those buildings. It can create, you know, vacant lots are ripe for, you know, hiding drugs or doing crime. It erodes the stability of the communities. And then you had unemployment in some of these places. So you really had neighborhoods that were traditionally stable that were rocked, as well as ones that were low income that were rocked.
One thing that I think is really interesting is you actually write about the Obamas and their tax returns as a comparison of wealth. And pre-White House, how do you think the Obamas' tax returns reflect a typical picture of Black wealth versus white wealth in this country?
This is when they were living in a condo. This was before Obama's book came out. And they lived in Hyde Park. And even though they were a six-figure income household, they did not their portfolio did not mirror those of their white peers of similar income. They mirrored Black households with lower income. And that's because they paid a marriage penalty, because Michelle Obama earned close to what her husband earned, and then sometimes more. And Black women have traditionally worked outside of the home and have been income earners, and the marriage penalty doesn't account for that. They also did not diversify their wealth. They didn't have stocks and bonds and dividends and things like that. They had their wealth only in their condo.
As we're talking about segregation, we've talked about housing, but I think one of the things we always think about, sort of, maybe it's a kind of in the back of our mind, but you really sort of lay out all the details of this, is how segregation impacts education. And there's a line you have in the book, Chicago's a multiracial city where people aren't learning together or about each other. And I wanted to go to the moment of the historic school closings that happened, I guess it's 2 years ago now, in Chicago, and ask, you know, how much of that was, there was so much outcry from the African-American community about those school closings. And you even write how you were worried about a school closing in your neighborhood because you were worried how it would affect property values. Where are we at with that now? Have there been ideas for those abandoned properties? Have there been ideas for, because our Chicago schools are very segregated right now.
We haven't seen anything totally come to fruition. There have been some sales of buildings. There have been some ideas to turn them into either residential spaces or some type of, you know, business model. But for the most part, these are just empty buildings that are languishing on the city south and west sides. For me, you know, the point of my chapter was not so much about the school closings, even though I mentioned them, but is about a lack of imagination in promoting integration in Chicago public schools. And research just simply shows that integration is good for blacks, it's good for whites, it's good for all races. And I thought that the school closings could have been an opportunity to do something creative to address that issue. And whenever I have gone to CPS about integration and segregation, they don't have an answer. They just give me a boilerplate answer. Well, we want everyone to have a high quality education.
Well, and I think that reflects in a way, Mayor Emanuel, you make this interesting distinction in the book about Chicago politics today that it's neoliberal. And what do you mean by that? And who do you think loses out most with these, as you're characterizing, like sort of these neoliberal policies?
Neoliberalism is the privatization of a lot of traditional city services. And it's argued that neoliberalism helps people who are more affluent, and it leaves working class and lower income people behind. Parking meters can be looked at as a neoliberal policy, selling the parking meters to get some short-term cash, getting rid of your government workforce or slimming it down to privatize it to other companies when it necessarily hasn't been proven that those companies are going to do a better job than the government workers.
Yeah. How much do you think Chicago segregation echoes, or how much do you think it's maybe a microcosm or a reflection of the entire country?
Well, that's why I have American in my subtitle, because I'm writing about Chicago, but we see this happening in many other cities across the United States, particularly in the Midwest and the Northeast. The one thing that has come out of the uprisings in Ferguson and Baltimore is that I think there is more conversation happening about segregation and the conditions and communities that lead to people wanting to revolt, whether it's against police brutality or bad housing.
Natalie, we just have about 2 minutes left, and you end the book by saying journalists are not often solution-oriented. So I wanted to offer to you a question about how you recommend, first of all, before we even get to solutions, just how we should be thinking about segregation in this country, not just the costs, but how we should really be taking a more nuanced approach to this.
I think we first have to acknowledge it in a real way. I write that segregation in Chicago is like air and water. It just is. We don't think about it. We just accept that this is how our city is. And I believe if we stop and think about why it is, that's the first step in understanding our communities. It's not simply saying, well, yeah, we're segregated. That's just how it is. Well, why is it that way? And why do we accept it?
That's Natalie Moore. She's the author of The South Side, A Portrait of Chicago and American Segregation. She's going to be at Printers Row Festival in Chicago this Sunday afternoon. We tweeted out those links. If you want more information on that, you can follow the 21st show. But Natalie, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Stay tuned to this encore edition of the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. You're listening to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. This is a special rebroadcast of a previous episode. Have you checked out our digital presence lately? If you follow us on Twitter, that's 21STShow. Especially when we're on the air, we're tweeting out links that provide more context and analysis to the conversation we're having. We also keep you up to date on Illinois news throughout the day. Our Facebook page, Search for the 21st, is where you can go to see previews of upcoming shows. And you can comment or add questions you want us to ask on air. And past shows are also available via the NPR One app or on iTunes and Android. Speaking of podcasts, here's some of NPR's Hidden Brain.
What are the odds? We thought we might find out. We'll talk about the mathematics of coincidences.
That particular kind of coincidence, meeting an acquaintance or somebody you're familiar with in a very strange place, I would say perhaps 80% of all the coincidences I've heard fall into that category.
And we'll explore why we are drawn to coincidences and what our fascination with them can tell us about the human mind.
Whenever you see something that you can't explain, the natural human instinct is to try to understand it. But that can also mean that sometimes we over-explain things.
For the past year, the NPR podcast Hidden Brain has been exploring the unconscious patterns that shape our views and drive human behavior with the goal of helping listeners better understand the world and themselves. The podcast tackles all kinds of issues, from climate change and terrorist attacks to risk perception and how our family background influences our politics. The host of that podcast is NPR science correspondent Shankar Vedantam, and he joins us now to talk about his podcast and what they have planned for their fall lineup. Shankar, thanks so much for being with us. Welcome to the 21st.
Hi, Naila. So happy to be here. Thank you for having me.
First of all, congratulations on celebrating 1 year of Hidden Brain.
Thank you so much.
What have been the most memorable moments for you from the past year of hosting the podcast?
Well, the most memorable moments are not getting any sleep for almost 12 months as we've turned out an insane amount of material. But we've also touched on a lot of topics that I think are very interesting. We've looked at everything from how people can better stick to their resolutions to how you can better motivate your children and your employees to very serious topics, you know, why we sometimes might not take global climate change as seriously as we should, or how people can get radicalized and join terrorist groups.
You know, the name of the podcast seems to suggest that there's a lot about the human mind that we just don't understand. And I wonder, does it get daunting to explore issues that even the best scientists say we know very little about?
I wouldn't use the word daunting. I think it's actually, it's great fun. I mean, I think I completely agree with your description, which is that there's so much about how the mind works that is really still a mystery to us. But I think as journalists, what that gives you is sort of a ringside seat into the most interesting action in the world of science. I mean, how the mind works, how the brain produces thoughts, how this produces, you know, feelings and opinions and attitudes. These are really big and important questions that we're only beginning to get a handle on. And the fact that I can be a journalist and I can talk to very smart people who are thinking about these complicated issues, and the fact that these complicated issues touch the lives of everyone who listens to public radio, everyone who listens to the media, that totally is the sweet spot to be as a journalist.
Well, and you all do, I think, such a great job of not just exploring the science, but mixing it in with compelling human stories. And I'm thinking about a recent episode. You explored an issue I think that's particularly pertinent during this election season, the political divide. And you asked the question, how does our family and our upbringing influence our politics? You talked to researchers about the hidden moral frameworks we're not even aware of, but how much of a powerful force they are in influencing our preferences. And I wonder, when you explore topics like this, are you hoping that people will emerge with not just a better understanding of themselves, but maybe in this case of people who are very different or on the polar opposite side of them on the political spectrum?
I think that is exactly our hope. And in fact, I have to say that that hope has been justified because we heard a lot from people after that episode, people on, you know, all sides of the political spectrum, saying it was one of the few things they'd heard this election season that was more about light and information and perspective than, you know, heat and anger and accusation and attacks. You know, the idea behind that episode was really based on the work of a cognitive linguist in California, George Lakoff. He made an interesting observation some years ago that when you look at our political discourse, we often use metaphors related to the family. So we have homeland security and we have founding fathers and we send our sons and daughters to war and we don't want missiles in our backyard. And George Lakoff, who is a linguist, asked himself, is it possible that these are not just figures of speech, but do these metaphors actually shape the way we think about politics? And based on the insight that really, you know, all of us, our first experience with authority, our first experience with being governed, for most of us, that experience is in the family, right? You have parents who tell you what to do, who shape the rules, who tell you, you know, what you can get away with and what you can't get away with. And Lakoff's idea, it was really a hypothesis, was, is it possible that the kind of families we grow up in and the models of how we think a family should operate might inform the way we think about politics and inform things that are much, much, much larger than families? And there's been some empirical support to this idea, analyzing presidential ads, and that's what we explored in that episode.
Shankar, are you reading scholarly article journals all day, or are you always on blogs? How do you decide what topics you're going to pick?
I am reading very widely in the academic literature. In fact, as I am talking with you, I have an article here in case we started 5 minutes late so that I could do some reading.
What's that article about?
So this might be a story that I will explore for the radio at some point, but it explores a really interesting idea, which is that news can often have an impact on the outcome of an election. And we've all heard about the idea called an October surprise. So the question is, what is the best time to actually drop a bombshell if you actually want to influence the outcome of an election? And it turns out this is a surprisingly complicated idea because, on the one hand, the nearer to an election you drop a bombshell, the more impact it can have. But it's also the case that that information is less likely to be vetted and less likely to be seen as credible. The earlier you drop it, the more likely it's seen to be as credible, but it's also more likely to get shot down. And so this was a paper that's trying to model out, if you are trying to drop a bombshell, what's the best time to do it?
That's interesting. So how do you balance how do you balance science with stories? Do you the stories drive the scientific content, or do you choose a specific idea and then try to find people that illustrate it?
I think we've done a little bit of both, but I think in general, we're a podcast that really takes the science seriously and wants to adhere to what the science is finding in terms of the empirical findings. And so I would say more often than not, we're starting with the science. We're starting with interesting ideas from the social science research or, you know, a body of work that's been developed over time. And then we're keeping our eyes open for things in the news or things, stories that can help, you know, provide anecdotes for that research. Now, that's not always the way it works. Sometimes the anecdotes do come first. Someone comes up with a really compelling story. Sometimes we just tell it to our listeners as a story. And we, you know, the last week we had an episode that had very little by way of science. It narrated the story of a person who suffers a horrific attack on a train in Washington, D.C. But something very, very, very surprising comes as a result of that attack. And, you know, we presented the story largely as a narrative without really giving people a lot of social science to think about. And so sometimes we have a mix. You know, so sometimes the science comes first and is pulling the stories behind it. Sometimes the stories come first and we find the science to flesh it out and build it out.
What's going to be, so your fall lineup actually began at the end of last month on September 27th. It's is there a theme, or are you focusing on, what are you focusing on differently for this second season of Hidden Brain?
We're doing a lot of episodes right now that are tied to the presidential election. It's just something that a lot of people are talking about at length. And so we're doing a lot of episodes that are looking at the election. Now, because it's a podcast, people don't always listen to the episode when you put it out. So some people might be listening 4 weeks from now or 8 weeks from now or 6 months from now. And so when we build these episodes, we're trying to be both timely and timeless so that people can listen right now and draw references or inferences about things connected to the news. But people can also listen in 6 months' time and still find something to take away from it. Our episode this past week has looked at the history of immigration to the United States and a curious pattern where we see groups come to the United States and often experience prejudice and discrimination. But within a very short period of time, sometimes as little as 20 years, the same groups turn around and are now expressing concerns and worries about people who just arrived.
Right.
Yeah. And so this pattern of sort of groups coming and feeling discriminated against, but turning around very quickly and then expressing the same kind of concerns about other people who've come after them appears to be sort of a perennially American story. This coming week, we're going to look at another episode, another issue that's connected to the presidential election, the challenge that women often face in acquiring high office and reaching for high office. And that's true, certainly true if it's political office. It's also true if it's, you know, the corner office at your company. We've had women, prominent women, run for president on both the Republican and Democratic tickets this year. So this provides us an opportunity to look at all of the social science research that explores why it is that women often have to walk this very, very narrow line in order to be viable candidates, to be seen as candidates who can be both competent decent candidates as well as likable people whom we would like to see as president or CEO.
I wonder if you have time to answer this. Do you have pull back the curtain a little bit? Shankar, can you pull back the curtain a little bit and give us a behind the scenes look? For example, that episode you were talking about with women, what kind of work happens behind the scene to make each episode?
So I think what people often don't appreciate is how much effort goes into making audio stories. You know, and it's a little bit like when you go and watch, you know, when I watch a movie and the movie is really beautifully made and the story hangs together, there's a feeling that there is something effortless about it. And you come out of the movie thinking, well, I could have made that movie. You know, it all hung together so easily. But of course, what you're not seeing is that in order to make that effortless movie, there are just countless hours of people spending all kinds of attention and detail on sort of the really, really small things. So with the episode that looks at female leaders, I mean, this is an episode where clearly the science came first. It's sort of this voluminous body of social science research that looks at a phenomenon that sometimes called a double bind. And once we identified what the research was and who the researchers were, we went out then and tried to find stories of people who, you know, could illustrate what the science is finding. We also found a couple of very prominent political figures, a Republican and a Democrat who've served in high office, one in the U.S. Senate and one in the U.S. Congress, to sort of help us talk about how the social science might play out in real life. And then the challenge is, how do you put everything together? How do you put it together in a way that makes it feel like one seamless story? I'm not sure we achieved the goal of sort of seeming like it's effortless every week, but that's certainly the aspiration.
Do you start each episode with something you hope listeners will walk away with? Is that kind of a framing concept that you guys have?
You know, I think we've started episodes in all kinds of different ways. Sometimes when the episode is more narratively driven, you sort of jump right into the story and you want to bring people into the narrative as quickly as possible and almost get everything else out of the way. Sometimes when you're exploring an episode that's really about an idea, you want to flesh out what the idea is and give people sort of signposts and markers to help them orient themselves in the story. One of the things that makes audio stories different than print stories is that the listener often doesn't know exactly where they are in the story. They don't know if they're at the beginning, the middle, the end. And so you have to provide people with signposts to let them know, here's what you just heard, here's what you're hearing now, here's what you're going to hear. If you don't do that, people can feel disoriented when they're listening to an audio story in ways that doesn't happen with the print story.
I wish we had more time to talk to you about the science of how you put together a radio story, because I bet you have more insight into this than most of us in public radio. But you can catch The Hidden Brain. Its second season is out now. Its host is Shankar Vedantam. Thanks so much for being with us, Shankar.
Thank you so much for having me, Naila. It's been a pleasure.
That does it for this special Encore edition of The 21st. Thanks for listening. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app. Search for The 21st. We're also available on iTunes and Android. If you want to send us an email, leave us a voicemail, follow us on social media, all you have to remember is our website, 21stshow.org. If you follow us on Twitter, search for 21stshow. We live tweet during the program with more analysis and background about what we're talking about. When we're not on air, you can follow that for the latest Illinois news. On our Facebook page, search for The 21st. To like us, you can comment on what we're working on or post questions or comments you want us to ask on air. We're produced by Hala Delahi, Christine Herman, and Sean Newman. Technical direction comes from Jason Croft with help from Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Thanks to Joe Yoon and Nick Vance from the University of Illinois' Social Media Analytics Lab for their research help. And special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. I'm Naila Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.